So I'm here with Gerry O'Connor, wonderful fiddler from Ireland, who's been entertaining us all weekend at the Australian Celtic Festival. Gerry, our first question I like to ask musicians is about their beginnings. So when did you first hold a fiddle in your hand?
Hi, Pamela. Great to be here in Glenennis. Looking back, I remember standing in the front room of our home and my mother measuring me up for a fiddle to see what size it would be. You put the fiddle under your chin and you put your hand around the scroll, and if you get around the scroll, that means that the fiddle's a good size for you. Now, we didn't have any access to small fiddles at the time, so the fiddles were always a little bit big. I think I started on a three-quarter size fiddle, even though I was only six. And I remember dancing around, I was a dancer as well, and I was dancing around the fiddle. My father said, it'll be a while before you can do that. But eventually I did that. So I think I was six and a half, seven when I put the fiddle under my chin first. My mother put the fiddle under my chin.
And you come from a very musical family, don't you?
Yeah, well, my mother taught all of us, my two brothers, my sister, all fiddle. But she came from a family of five sisters who played music and a brother. Four of the girls played the fiddle, her brother played the fiddle, and one of her sisters played the accordion. Never understood that. But anyway, she did. And then her parents were my Aunt Lizzie O'Brien. She was a fiddle player and concertina player, and her husband, John, played the flute and fiddle. So there's music on both sides. And even on my grandfather's side, maternal, his sister had a collection of music, which I'm working through at the moment. She was a school teacher, and she wrote a lot of tunes. And it goes back to 1902, I think, because the first tune in the collection was The King of the Cannibal Islands. I mean, people were just learning anything and everything at the time that they could hear. Yeah, so in my case, it was right back. And then my kids all played music as well. My late wife, Edna, was a singer and flute player. And our kids, Donald, plays fiddle, guitar and piano. And Shuan plays the fiddle and sings, like her mum. Fallamy sings in Irish and Gaelic, and plays flute and plays guitar. And Finian is over here at the moment playing with the Mary Wallopers, pipes and fiddles. Yeah. And then the younger family, they're all playing piano and fiddle. Piano and flute. And then my daughter, she's resisting learning the fiddle.
There's always a rebel. How many O'Connors have been on stage together at one time?
We had 13 O'Connors, all O'Connor. And then my wife Sheila, Sheila Boylan, she's a fiddle player as well. But she comes from a musical family. But she uses the O'Connor name when she's on stage with the O'Connors. We play with Clan O'Connor, Clanny Cruher, you know, whatever. It's, we don't do very much because everybody's so busy and scattered and that. But it's good fun. And we play some of the old repertory. We played with Lalu, the band, and some of the songs that it. And it's always good fun. Everybody's in good behaviour because nobody wants it to be the one that caused a problem amongst the family. You know, you can't walk away from a family. You're always family, no matter whether you want to be there or not.
Now, one of the things you've been talking about on your tour of Australia is the Rose in the Gap, this project arising from this wonderful little music manuscript. Can you talk a bit about that?
Grew up a musician. I was young playing and I was pretty good in the early stages. So I was always the young member of everything I was in. And everybody was always 12 years older than me, or 12 or 14. And I ended up playing in this bar, Mark's Bar in Dundalk, which was a very important part of musical history. It was equidistant to Dublin and Belfast. One hour to Dublin, one hour to Belfast. So a lot of musicians would have gathered there coming down from Belfast. And the Dubliners played, the town hall was across the road. So it was always a great interest in music. And it was so good that the Maeve co-owner, she would close the door of the pub once the music started. So only people who were interested, she let them in. There was no such thing as, well, let's go in, there's a bit of background noise in here. So I became the resident musician there after Peter McCardle passed away, and that's when I walked into the pub. The door was open this day and the music was on, and I looked around and these people knew, someone recognised me, and I was handed a fiddle and I became the resident fiddle player. And I was there for a couple of years playing at weekends, and this man, Johnny Gallagher, gave me a photocopy of an old article that was in the Loud Archaeological Journal. The Loud Archaeological Journal was set up in 1904. It was a gathering of professionals and academics from the area who wanted to highlight the richness of the built heritage and of the oral heritage in the area. And there was a priest that had put this article together called Reverend Luke Donlan. And I was handed the article and I read through it. There was 106 tunes in it. And I started playing tunes from it, and then Ed and I started playing tunes from it as part of our band Lalu. Lu being the pan-Celtic god of creativity, gave his name to County Loud, Kundalui, Louvain, Leiden, and many places like that. Carlisle, I believe. We started working through those tunes, and then I was asked to do a master's in Dundalk under Fintan Valerie. And he asked me about doing a master's on this collection of music, which I had referred to in many of the albums. I'd never seen the full collection. I went to Dublin to the UCD, to the Folklore Commission. Rina Neoghan introduced me to it. and it was a small little notebook. It's an A5, roughly size, of the manuscript. It was well worn, and there was parts of it missing from page. It starts at about, well, tune number 10, so three pages missing of it because there was an index in it. So I basically transcribed that, edited it, and formatted it, and reimagined it in a modern context using Sibelius, and included some information at the early part of it about the cultural revival in the area that created the situation where this music was published in the first place in 1909. So it's a body of tunes that, nearly 300 tunes in total, mostly reels. At the beginning of the book is lost, and I think it's broken in half or whatever, because there's no jigs. There's an index of reels that showed there had been three pages missing, and I presume there was an index of jigs. There was no collections in the area that didn't include jigs. There was the McGann collection, there was another Piper's repertory, and most of them, about 40% of tunes were jigs, jig rhythms, 12-8, 6-8. So, unfortunately, there's no jigs in this collection. But with this Peter McCardle passed away, he had a lot of unusual jigs and were recorded by Brendan Brannock, the collector, back in 1971. So when I'm researching for album music and that, I used the Peter McCardle's for the jigs and the Donlan collection for the reels and everything in between. There's different tunes. There's a lot of old dances like Bessie Ballack's in it, the Drowsy Man's Hornpipe. And these are all old dances from the area. But judging by the material that's in it, there's even a version of Oh Susanna and No Place Like Home. So it can't be that old. But yet, I would, just by the repertory that's in it, I would imagine about 1870 to 1890, somewhere in that period.
Fascinating. And do you think some of the tunes are much older than that and they were just being recorded and reworked then?
Yeah, well, you can imagine this person, whoever wrote down the tunes, had to learn them first. There was no such thing as recording them and writing them out and moving on. They had to be learned, and every note in them that I could read was accurate. There was no mistakes in the melodies. There was errors in the key signature indicators and a bit of barring here and there. But it was older tunes. The tune, The Rose in the Gap, the title I used for the book, it was written above it, Rosha Ata. And that sounds like, probably within living memory, this was the title of the tune, which the Rosha Ta Savarna would be the Rose in the Gap. And I presume that was just remembered as Rosha Ta, and then the English was written after the Rose in the Gap. Like many of the tunes, but mostly dance tunes, the reels, and there are airs in the back of it. And Donlan had collected other tunes. One of the little melodies was published in the Loud Archaeological Journal of 1909, and it was Colin Jess, Crittin' the Mo, The Pretty Girl Milking the Cow.
That tune has an Australian connection, do you know?
I don't.
It's said to have been played in the pub at Glenrowan when Ned Kelly was besieged. You know the story of Ned Kelly?
Well, I know about Ned Kelly. Yeah, I was in the town where he was in court.
Yeah.
Beechwood. Mm. Yeah.
He was besieged, or I can't even remember the story myself, but he was in the pub, right, and the police were outside surrounding the pub, and he had whoever was in the pub at the time was just locked in with him, and it said that he got this young boy to sing, and the boy sang that song. In Irish. Amongst the Irish language enthusiasts in Australia, it's a bit of a legendary event, that little-known fact. But yeah, so it's fantastic to have a back-home connection to the song.
And it's interesting because Donlan put 106 tunes from the bigger, as I call it, the bigger collection that was not researched. But that particular song was the only song that wasn't in the tune book, let's say, the big tune book. Mm. And whatever reason, he tagged it on at the very end of the 106. So in technically there was 105 taken from the plus cutting jets creating a book. So I wonder if that's just pure coincidence, or was it, if maybe there was a popular myth or something at the time? But it's interesting that I never made that connection before, and that's fascinating. We're all learning here today.
You speak of jigs and reels, so these are obviously written to dance to originally. Do you know much about the tradition of dancing to this music in that region? Is that something that's part of the story?
Well, there would be. One of the tunes written is a Bessie Black, and I know that tune was played in the old, up in North County Down. Nigel Boulier published a fascinating collection of dance music from Northeast County Down, and it was where the Gaelic League, Conradh na Gaeilge, had not had any influence. At the turn of the century, with the cultural revival, Conradh na Gaeilge decided that they were going to try to do away with the old British dances, the quadrilles and the lancers and all that, which were danced. And they created new dances like the Waves of Tory, Siege of Ennis, Walls of Limerick. But in the northeast of Ireland, because it was still more a unionist tradition, Protestant tradition, they were not influenced by the Conradh na Gaeilge dance masters and teachers. So they retained their old dances. And that was one of the dances that was danced. But it was also danced in Sells Armagh, because I knew a man called Michael Quinn, who was a storyteller. And he remembers it being danced. He couldn't remember the pattern of the footsteps, but he did remember it being danced. And Jackie Dunnan, in Nigel Boulier's book, he mentions as well that he knew the dance. And I knew him briefly in the late 70s. And he played in big houses in North County County Down back in the 50s and 40s, and he remembered the dance. So they were sort of dances that would have been unique to the northeast of Ireland. Like when I talk about the region, we're talking about between Dublin and Belfast, the Oriel region would have been one of the old land tracts that would have been under the Irish pre-Elizabethan put in the counties. And today it basically stretches from South County Down, South Armagh, East Monaghan, East Cavan, and North Meath and North Louth, basically. So it's at the moment we describe it as, if you drew the compass around Louth or from Dundalk, it's probably about 40 miles inland from any, roughly, that's the area we're talking about.
Quite a specific little area, and it's lovely to have such localised traditions preserved. Yeah. A lot of people would think of Irish music as being something amorphous that covers the whole island.
Yes.
It's not like that at all, is it?
No, and I suppose it goes right back to cultural revival, and we had partition in the area as well, so the travel was restricted, and then later on the Troubles, Northern Ireland, people tended not to go near the area for tourist purposes. I mean, numerous people see me, oh, I've been to Ireland, I say, yeah, and they went to Dublin, they went to Cork, they went to Galway and back to Dublin, unless they've been around a few bit more than that for their first visit. So it's an area that has probably been pretty much untapped musically and culturally for many generations. And like, we always were learning tunes from Cork, for Kerry or Clare or Donegal or whatever, and it's only this collection, what it does, it creates a geographic identity to the area, cultural and historical body of tunes. I mean, I've played through the tunes, and when I had the small collection first, I played through it, and there was not too many tunes. I did learn a little tune called Stirling Tom, which is quite unusual, from which it's in a key of D minor and F, and it's quite unusual. So this collection was probably a fiddle player's collection, because this many of the Scottish tunes were, some of them written in those Fs, and that it wouldn't be written by a flute player, let's say, or a piper necessarily. So yeah, but there is a geographic link to it all, and even some titles, Black Rock Reel is in it. Not too many local references on tune titles, which with Francis O'Neill, his collection had many name place locations, because I think just finished reading his new biography there, O'Neill. It's called the Beat Cop. It's what I gathered, what he employed young men in the police force, and if they were from Ballinamore, the tune was called Ballinamore Lassies or something, and that's the first time, according to Fintan Valley, that place names were associated with Irish dance tunes. Often they were, Fasten the Leggin or Saddle the Pony, sort of ordinary titles like that, but not necessarily focusing on the place names. Now, there are tunes that are called the Newcastle Reel, which is Newcastle County Down or Newcastle Scotland or England, I don't know. But I'd say a third of the tunes are from the Scottish collections. You've got Miss Lyle, you have Lord Lumner, and you have various typical Scottish, that are honouring the aristocracy in Scotland, ladies, lords, all that. And then you had even the Highland Lad and all that. So I'd say that the collection was heavily influenced by the Scottish planted tradition in South Ulster. And even Mick Quinn said to me one time, oh, we used to go up north to hear different tunes, and it was basically to the bigger, maybe bigger repertory of tunes. Also, the Scottish collections were written down and more accessible than the Irish collections at the time. So, and people, they're not fussy where they're going to learn a tune. Once it's a new tune and they're bringing it into an area, that's what it's all about. They're not agonising over whether it's a Scottish tune or an Irish tune. And I think just with the foundation of the state and in the 50s of the music, people were trying to, again with the Irish dancing, they tried to eliminate the colonial military dances and bringing in the Waves of Tory, and even the name checking of Siege of Enniskillen, Waves of Tory, Walls of Limerick, each has a specific town attached to it, making it Irish. So in this collection there was such a big body of Scottish tunes. Also, everything was written in 4/4 time, even Off She Goes, the tune, and you wonder, was that a mistake? Was the writer not aware of time keysing? Other places it was written in flats and everything, so it was an awareness, but maybe tunes were played in different rhythms. I've noticed that songwriters will change a song from 4/4 into 12/8 and make a different melody, a swing to it. And why wouldn't music? Just because it's written down in one way doesn't mean it has to be always played like that.
Now, you've travelled the world playing the fiddle
and doing
musical things. I'd be really interested in your take on how Irish fiddle tradition, how is that? Do you see that it's different in different places, like in America? Do they do it differently from Australia? And is that, how is it like?
It's a tricky one. I'm burning all my bridges here. But seriously, traditional music has really flourished in the last number of years. And the fiddle being a universal instrument, a lot of people will come in and say, oh, I love this Irish music, and they'll get by a book and they'll play tunes out of a book. That's brilliant. And I spend my time going around and working with these people who they know the tunes, but the style of playing them and patterns of bowing is my area of interest. I can look at fiddle playing and see what's going on. And I think pipers don't have this problem, for example, because you only learn pipes from a piper. But violins players can become fiddle teachers, and they don't really have it's a bit like somebody having linguistic skills but not understanding or not having the linguistic skills and teaching a language. So you get a lot of people playing the tune as it's written, and they don't, especially on the fiddle, it doesn't get the swing that it needs. And also there's a Scottish way approach to playing the fiddle, which is getting technical now. They play on the beat, we play the swing note up there, pick up note, the anacrusis, and we swing that into the, I'm talking about reels now, like Scottish music, we go da 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 da, and Irish ones go da 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 da, and it's like it's in a natural lilt. Somebody lilts a tune, da 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 da, and to me that's the bowing. And it's a bit like Balinese drumming, where they have a tick-a-tack, they have a language to teach drumming. And I was often thinking if we could develop, maybe get people to lilt a tune before they play it. The I is the tie, and then the two singles. And, oh, anyway, that's. Yeah. But you go back to your question, and the spread of traditional music is fantastic for us all in many ways, and it's just created. There's a lot of adult learners as well coming into the music, I find, and these are people who might have learned music as a kid. And I suppose it's way back before my time of learning, my mother's time of learning, maybe in the 30s, you'd no recording facilities for a start. Mm-hmm. So you sat beside somebody and you learned their repertory, and that was what you learned, and not just the repertory, but the way they played it. Now you could walk, like a closet musician could come out of their bedroom after 6 months having learned everything on YouTube. And the thing is, what YouTube and those, they don't really have a reference of what the music is. I mean, anybody can put anything up and they're not qualified in any way or of any. I'm talking about specifically fiddle, but it's all well intentioned. But there's a woman there lately I played with, and she started a tune, and it's a tune that's only played in America in Irish sessions, but it's not played by Irish musicians. And the tune's called Swallowtail. And I know it from hearing it around America. And this is an example. And then I said, well, that's interesting. I never heard that tune played in Ireland. And she got a little bit flustered. I said, no, it's okay. I was just curious because I only hear. Oh, she said, I learned it off a young girl on YouTube. Whereas I played with John DeGardner. And John DeGardner was a fiddle player from Sligo who came to Dundalk. His buddies, Michael Coleman, went to America. Michael Coleman, James Morrison, who he knew personally. And John Joe came to Dundalk, and I was playing with him. And my mother taught me the fiddle, but I learned watching John Joe. And I played with him for three nights a week during the summer for 4 years. And he was going to copy me, but I was going to have to copy him. And that's where I learned a lot of my style of my fiddle playing, was by playing with a good musician. And I think fiddle players suffer a lot from the fast session. You know, you can play a whistle player can play a reel in one breath, nearly.
Yeah.
Have to play it fast enough. Whereas if it's fast, the fiddle players suffer, and then they get the tune, but they don't get the style of playing it. It's a little hobby horse, man. How long have we got to talk about it?
It's very interesting, though, and that personal or sort of hand-to-hand transmission.
Yeah.
Has such a huge role in Irish traditional music.
Yeah, and it does, because at the end of the day, it's only a series of dots, but it's the story that goes with it, and who you learn it from, and the context it's learned in. And I think it just respects some of the older musicians. I did a track on an album there lately, and I selected tunes that were played by older musicians who were never recorded professionally. And one tune was, first tune I learned from a fiddle player from Tyrone, Johnny Loughran. Johnny was a blind fiddle player. He was recorded, but not. I don't know if he's on any commercial albums. But we had the old recordings, tape recordings of him. And the next tune was from Peter McCardle, fiddle player in the Dog. Again, his music is in the archive, at the ITMA, the Irish Traditional Music Archive. But he never, I think he was on one track. On one album. But then, and the other fiddle player, the other musician then was a flute player from Fermanagh band called Mahon, James McMahon. And he actually wrote a tune that was made very popular by the Bothy band. But the Banshee. But it was nearly like a little subtext to the track, was that these are musicians that are will never be heard outside, or their names might be forgotten. And I think that's a thing that I'm interested in. I'm involved in the local archive at home, in the Oriel Traditional Music Archive. And my thing is, I'm worried about the cassettes all being thrown out of all these flats where people went around and recorded in the 50s and 60s. Their kids, no harm, but they've no way of playing them. And they'll just usher those old tapes. And it's so random as well. I know that people have recorded lots of conversation. But I think that it's probably a body of work. Otherwise, the net of traditional music is very narrowed down to the ones who are commercially recorded, the ones who are recorded by archives. Whereas the width of the music, it'll be lost in this generation if we don't. It's not that they're all wonderful musicians, but it's a written record of music being played in a region at a time in a style that will be lost.
Turn you in a slightly different direction. You have quite a mechanical interest in fiddling because you make fiddles as well.
Yeah, I studied making. A friend of mine brought me down to hear Joe Pass play the guitar, the famous jazz guitarist. Went down to hear him and met the trad people then and discovered there's a violin making course in Cork. I'd been in industrial engineering with a mining company in Navan, County Meath, and I'd always wanted to work with my hands. I had made a, as soon as I left school, I started a night class, and I made a coffee table and a rocking chair and things that, and then there's a mandolin making course in Navan, and I made a mandolin, and I found I had good enough skills. So I went to Cork and studied violin making there. Now I knew I was probably late getting into it, and Ireland didn't have an industry of shops to take in the apprentices, which we learned in the course, but there was no follow on, and it was a bit unfortunate. But it allowed me then to develop my music and play a lot more. I was in Cork, and the first weekend I was in Cork, I played the Cork Folk Festival. And what I have now is I started touring then with Jackie Daly, Jimmy Crowley in America, and later on with Dolores Keane and John Faulkner and Jackie. But the violin workshop allowed me to not be on the road all the time. That I have this small workshop. When I go home now, there'll be a number of jobs lining up to to get repairs. But it's not like your plumber and the water's leaking through the house. You know, the fiddle can be put aside, and I can even loan somebody fiddles. And it's lovely company as well. People come out to cheer, you know, the fiddles and bits, and I say, oh, it can be fixed. It's a nice, it's most instruments can be restored. And it's also a great company. I try to have a nice workshop, and I have it all pretty clean. I used it there during COVID for a little hangout, I call them, my programs of playing music. And it was nice because, you know, people said, oh, what's that behind your head there? What sort of a fiddle is that? And you could say, rather than just, like a lot of people recording from their bedrooms and dodgy hanging coloured curtains behind. So yeah, they work for, and it's very nice work, because I mean, when you're on the road, you're talking, you're engaging, you're socialising, and the workshop, just put a talk radio and get on with the job. And it's a nice contrast in work, and it's clean. It's, I have the workshop right beside the house, and I can walk in and boil up the glue and go back and have a coffee and do a bit of gluing or repair, wait for something to dry. And it's a nice balance of lifestyle.
So you are going home from here. What else have you got in store this year?
Yeah, well, we're going to Brisbane for a few days. I'm at this festival because Melanie Cole from the band Limerick suggested that I come out for this festival. When I finish here, just before this tour, I was in the States for a tour, a 5-week tour, talking, teaching, playing tunes. I go back to the States in 3 weeks now, end of May. And I go to a festival, in teaching festival down in Louisiana. It's interesting to say, when I was doing the COVID hangout programs, people would write in, I'd be going out live on Facebook, and people say, oh, hi, Jerry from wherever, Germany, or friends of mine would check in it. And this lady says, hi, from Louisiana. And I just set the camera, I said, never been to Louisiana. And she texts back in, and, well, when are you coming out? So we created a week's work there for me. It's a festival, that's my third visit. And then I go up to the northeast, up to Maine, and I'll teach up there. Talk about the collection, talk and play, and a few concerts. And then I'm back home and for the Willie Clancy Summer School. That's a big summer school in Clarin. I was sent to that the very first year of it, back in 1973. There was six of us in the fiddle class. Sean Keane was teaching us from the Chieftains, and wow, we had a great time. It was Maisie Friel's pub, we played there all day, and she fed us. And there was a small number of musicians, you know, mostly musicians of sons and daughters of musicians, because they were trying to get this is the very first of the week-long summer schools ever in Ireland of traditional music. There had been other weekends up in Gormanstown camp, but this is the first full week, and it was just amazing just to be there. And all the older musicians from the area were coming out. And so at that, now I'm back there, there's 40 fiddle teachers, and there's over 400 fiddle students. I think there's 3,000 students in total between set dancing and singing and instrumental, and all the instruments are there. Pipes are very strong there. My son went down there to learn the pipes. That's where he started his piping. Yeah, so that's, and then I fly to the States back to Catskills. There's a big week of teaching over there in Durham, in Newcastle, upstate New York. And Paul Keating is the organizer there, so he invited me out. And again, I think there's about 30 tutors there. A lot of people from the east coast, and that's all. That's traditional Irish music. And and then back home from, I stay on, and then I fly to Spain, work with Alistair Fraser, a great Scottish fiddler. He runs summer camps in the States, but this one he's asked me to do is one in northern Spain, in Burgos. Yeah, and then I'm home for a little while. Off to Norway then, there's an Irish festival. Again, it's the pattern, you know. You go up, you play, you teach, and your concerts and your sessions and that. That's been run by a musician friend of mine, Brendan Monaghan, and his partner, Cecile. She's a dancer, and so she organises that. He takes care of the music. So they're all small events, but they're all, everybody benefits. We get, you know, meet other musicians, and it's an occupation. It's a full-time job with Mina. And then after that, go back to the States in November and there's a big festival over there, fiddle festivals. It's all fiddlers from different styles, from American, you know, it's based in America, but you get Irish, Cajun, bluegrass, Quebecois. I sat in on a Turkish workshop there last year, 2 years ago. It's called Fiddle Hell, which it is.
Sounds amazing. So it's a very busy lifestyle you have. Must it be is. Lovely to have that workshop to retreat back into.
It is, yeah. Time. It is at times. And I've got young kids at home, and my wife Shade is very understanding. She knows this is what I do, and that's what I... And she has... I think she likes time to herself as well. Brilliant. I think she's glad. She's glad to see me go.
Nice to have the past to herself for a while.
Well, as I say, she understands it, yeah. And she gets on with her own life, and it's great, and the kids are good, and... It is tough at times, but I try and every year have a 2 month period just to myself. This year it'll be September, October. I try and just do some work at home. There's a harp festival down in September, just in Drogheda. It's a centenary of 280 years of the big harp festival there in Drogheda. So, and that's the Corrigan na Cruiche, Harp Ireland as it's called now. They organise it, Eileen McCran. And they always involve me with the harp festival, because there is a week long festival in County Louth in Termonfeckin, run by the Harp Ireland. And they always include me as a local voice, even though I'm not a harpist, but I'm a local musician, and I play at the concerts and all that. Yeah, I think the world of music is amazing. We were here with the Manx musicians, and Daniel was saying, "You must come to the island, man. We'll plan something for..." Just before this interview, he said, "We'll plan something for September." You know, that's the way we work, you know, yeah. Making work for each other, keeping in contact, and sharing our love of music, culture, and language, and all that goes with it, yeah.
What a beautiful community.
It is. And it's not everybody's. It was a friend of mine, he was an All-Ireland world champion dancer. His son was a world champion dancer, and his grandson has just qualified as a world champion dancer, Tony Ruddy. And I heard him saying something on a wee clip. He was on a wee clip on the video, and he used to say, "It's not everybody's world, but it's our world."
Absolutely.